the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
Welcome to What Radicalized You, a podcast of stories and experiences that have shaped people's ideas about our world and the way society should function.
This episode contains a content warning for mentions of sexual assault and suicide. Listener discretion is advised.
My name is Dante O'Hara. I go by he, him pronouns. Originally from California, a small, sleepy, sort of military town, not military family, but it was a low-income area, working-class area, Oceanside, California, which is now getting heavily gentrified. And it's a little bit north of San Diego, the city, so probably like 30 to 40-minute drive north of San Diego, the city, where my family's mostly from. My mother is originally from Jackson, Mississippi, and moved out when she was very young, when her brother was in the military in the Navy. So that's kind of how my family got to San Diego. And then my mother married my father, and then they ended up in Oceanside, which is a little bit north of the city. I went to school in Riverside, California, which is like an hour east of LA. My background's in engineering and physics. I have a PhD, not in any sort of politics or social sciences, straight up physics, material science. So, you know, making those connections as well is important if we're talking about imperialism. When I went into grad school, I actually moved to Columbus, Ohio for almost 4 years at Ohio State University. Long story short, which I guess this would tie into my What Radicalized Me story. I was a student at UC Riverside, and then my group up and left. I stayed back to finish my courses, and then I moved out there, didn't transfer universities. This kind of exposed me to a lot of forms of exploitation and, you know, as a Black person in this country, like super exploitation as well. And then also seeing how my colleagues were treated, specifically women and folks from other national groups. I spent about 4 years at Ohio State and then finished up my PhD in Northern California for a year on a fellowship program. And then I got a job in DC, which I am here now as a scientist, engineer, whatever you want to call it. I'm also an organizer outside of my day job. People may know me or my organization, the Claudia Jones School for Political Education, which was founded in early 2020. We say we were founded in Nicaragua because our first in-person events prior to the pandemic was at the Nicaraguan embassy, and we are very close friends with the ambassador from Nicaragua, Francisco Campbell, who's an Afro-Caribbean brother, was very involved with the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa as well, Sandinista, and we recently celebrated their 42nd anniversary for the Sandinista Revolution. I'm also a card-carrying communist, so I'm a member of the CPUSA. I have been since around 2016 or so. The Claudia Jones School was formed out of some forces here in DC that were either former or current members of the Communist Party, elders who were very active in the 1960s and 70s. Afro-Latino organizers, Puerto Rican, Black, came together and wanted to build a school. And the idea was to kind of frame it after other schools that were built prior to the McCarthy period, one being one that Claudia actually taught at herself, which was the Jefferson School for Social Science, which was based in Harlem, New York in the 1940s. And then another one, which was co-founded by William Patterson and his wife, Louise Thompson Patterson, Abraham Lincoln School in Chicago. And there was a few others scattered around the U.S., but those were the kind of two main ones that people know about in left spaces. You might know people that know about these schools before they were dismantled during the McCarthy period. I'm also involved with the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. That was formed out of the National United Committees to Free Angela Davis and also the Committees to Free Joanne Little in the early 1970s. And it was basically founded by the Communist Party as well. Charlene Mitchell, Louise Thompson Patterson, William Patterson, and many other forces, not only CP members, but other ones as well. It was kind of a continuation of many other formations going all the way back to the International Labor Defense, who defended the Scottsboro Boys in the South And then that kind of continued on into the National Negro Congress, which that eventually combined with the ILD in the 1940s and 50s to form the Civil Rights Congress, which people may know of because they might have heard of the We Charge Genocide petition that William L. Patterson submitted to the UN, along with other signees like W.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson and Angie Dickerson and Claudia Jones and many other people. That's kind of what I'm mostly involved with, and I work with many different groups in D.C., different formations. You know, I'm a very coalition type guy. I want to build broad movements because we cannot win liberation for our people or our class by ourselves, you know, in these little tiny sectarian groups. So it's important that we bring everyone together and also understand while we're bringing people together, like the centrality of fight against racism and also the understanding for like a working class position in a lot of these movements. So I view that as extremely important in my organizing work. Going back in my trajectory or history, you know, my father passed away when I was young. My brother dealt with a lot of depression and a lot of mental health issues when I was growing up. And, you know, I've always been kind of like this curious guy, like trying to figure out the answers to these questions. You know, why did my father pass away from like cancer? You know, why is my brother dealing with all these mental health problems? You know, my mother is a Black woman. She's extremely stressed out, you know, doesn't have a stable job, trying to take care of my brother and I. And she deals with racism consistently and also misogyny consistently throughout my experiences, like being around her and all this as well. And, you know, as I got older, you know, I went to college and this was around the time of Obama presidency. And, you know, I could have called myself like a quote unquote Obama liberal, like many people of my generation possibly did. For people that don't know, I'm almost 30 years old, I'm 29 years old. So that gives you some sense of my age. But, you know, I went to school around 2010, come out of California, right? So it's a quote unquote melting pot, you know, a lot of nationalities, a lot of different racialized people in one area, you know, a lot of Samoans, a lot of Latinos, or what we called like Chicanos or Mexican Americans back then, Black folks. And it was my community was extremely segregated. So I mentioned earlier that I grew up in a military town. So I grew up next to the back gate of Camp Pendleton. And for folks that may know that are listening in, Camp Pendleton was, you know, like a major military base during World War II on the West Coast. For, I guess, fighting the Japanese or whatnot. It's a Marine base. It's massive. It has a lot of land. And, you know, I grew up to, like, bombings every, like, other day. You can just hear them, like, up over the hill next to my house. And it was just, like, a normal thing. You know, it sounds like some fireworks or something like that. But these things that you grow up around is, you know, questionable. Why does this happen all the time? You know, I also grew up around the climate disasters, right? So I remember in high school, there was a massive fire. I remember I had a really close friend in is either Escondido or Vista, California, which is not far from my hometown. And these massive fires were going all throughout mostly the inland counties of San Diego that were getting hit really hard by these fires. A couple of days later, my friend got evacuated. He had to live with me for a couple of days. The sky was completely orange, and we had to wear basically like these masks that we're wearing now for the pandemic to keep the ash out of our lungs and stuff. That's still like pretty stuck in my memory. That I remember a couple years later, this is prior to me going to college in Riverside, the fires got worse and they were more consistent. It used to be fire season in California, like, you know, happened like early fall or something like that, similar to like hurricane season out here on the East Coast or whatever. And now it's like just fires every day, right? But this was starting to pick up when I was finishing up high school. And there was one time there was a fire. And next to my house, there's like this big golf course with these fire trails on the hill, which behind the hill is the base for the military. And these fire trails were to like lead the fire to like where they get extinguished easier. But one year, these fires like came all the way down to like where my house was. And I remember like it was, I don't know, maybe within an hour, we're like, okay, we're about to go. My mom was like, okay, we're going to pack up, go to Mississippi and go with our family because we're about to get our house burned down right now. She was like watering the house. It was intense, but there was like the fire was like eyesight, like it was like right about to jump over this little drain thing for like flooding. If it like hopped over, like it would have took out like all of our whole neighborhood. When I was in Ohio, there was a massive fire that was going on in LA and the Bay Area. I remember seeing the photos and I was just like, oh my God, like this whole state is going to have the most climate refugees in a couple of years because California is not going to survive this thing. It's just going to be burnt to hell and people are going to be displaced in mass. So I was going into college. Obviously, I couldn't vote the first term for Obama because I was young. I was below 18, whatever. But when I was going into college, 17, 18 years old, freshman year, UC Riverside, and I want to say the second year, Occupy was happening. And across the UC system, there were demonstrations going crazy over the tuition hikes that were getting implemented by the UC Regents. So the UC Regents, for listeners that don't know, are basically like the donor class for the University of California, the school system. And it's like a bunch of these rich donors who are possibly alumni, or they just donate a lot of money and then they get basically voting rights on what happens at the university. So, and these people decide like your tuition, all the fees, all this stuff. And if you're going back in history, you know, back to like the 1960s, for example, these people were responsible for firing Angela Davis when she was teaching at UCLA. That's one example. And then another example is later, while Ronald Reagan was still governor around this period, because he was like the one that basically pushed him to fire her over his anti-communism. At this time, in the late 60s, early 70s, during the uprisings against the Vietnam War, Black Panther Party, Brown Berets, etc., these folks were all fighting for Black and Latino faculty on campus. They were fighting for Black studies, Chicano studies, etc. on campus. Even the women were fighting for, like, you know, feminist studies, etc. And Ronald Reagan was governor. He was so pissed off that people were protesting on campuses to get on. It's like they basically wanted more admission rates to the schools, and they wanted more Black people there. They wanted Black faculty, and they wanted studies so they can learn their history, right? They were picketing on these campuses, you know, students and non-students, you know, organizers, etc. from the community. And at this time, tuition was $0 or very minimal if it existed. College was basically a public institution. It was free. You can go there to get a higher education. It was basically a free public institution. Once Black and brown folks started rising up for equality, the white folks can't have that, you know, the white ruling class can't have that. So what they did was, okay, if y'all Negroes and brown folks want to come into our campuses, y'all are going to have to go on these terms. So they started creating this thing called what we call now is like predatory inclusion, right? I love this term because you have this thing that came out of like the George Floyd protests with all these corporations, which is like diversity and inclusion, diversity and inclusion. And it's like, okay, yeah, we want to make things more diverse, equality, all that stuff. But if you're talking about the capitalists or the, you know, the corporations, all that stuff is going to be on a predatory basis. So if we go back in time, we can talk about redlining, we can talk about, you know, zoning for housing, we can talk about gentrification, we can talk about the education system, we're talking about, you know, student loan debt, and then we talk about healthcare, we're talking about all this medical apartheid, all this stuff as well. So inclusion on what basis? That's the question that you got to always ask after that. Why I was bringing it up is because I was talking about the Regents. There are two historical things that they've done in the past was implement tuition costs at universities in the California system, which got replicated across the whole country. And now we're in this conundrum now where this new bubble where people of our generation now hold the most debt next to people that hold mortgage. So it's like $1.8 trillion of student debt. I just want to plug another organization since we're talking about student debt. There's this militant debtors organization called the Debt Collective that I've been working with for the past year and a half or so. And they're basically fighting to organize debtors unions across the country. Their primary task is to fight for the cancellation of all student debt and then eventually fight for college for all. So like, you know, people don't accumulate debt anymore. You know, this is what people would term racial capitalism question, right? Or it's a racialized question within a capitalist system, where these austerity measures were implemented on the working class for students that wanted to get a higher degree, to get a better job, et cetera, et cetera. But those people who are typically going into those programs are now being integrated into those programs are now picking up all that debt because they come from extreme poverty, communities that have no jobs, or they've been displaced, et cetera, et cetera. And this is Black and brown people, and particularly Black women who hold the most student debt. So I was talking about Occupy, and this was happening. I want to say my spring of my freshman year or my early fall of my sophomore year. So this is like 2011, I want to say. Occupy was happening. Obama was president. I didn't really know what the hell was going on. I viewed it as like a white thing. At the time, it was mostly like white students on the campus, like, you know, in the main areas fighting against these tuition hikes. You know, people camped on campus, right? They had these tents everywhere. But it wasn't massive on my campus. It was more just like kind of spontaneous. And looking back at it, I understand why. But at the time, yeah, it was just kind of like this thing was happening. People were protesting. And then there was people that they were doing sit-ins at the Regents meetings that were in this one building. They all got arrested. The tuition still increased at like a higher rate while I was in school. So like it wasn't like I'm in a lot of debt still. So I'm a reflection of that whole thing. You know, my mother struggled while I was in school. You know, I'm in a lot, picking up a lot of debt, but I'm ignoring it because I don't want to worry about money while I'm in school. Okay. Then I'm kind of getting under an orbit of, you know, a lot of black mentors, not black radicals, but like, you know, black professionals, middle-class folks that come from poverty, but, you know, have a very middle-class attitude towards life. And these Southern California Negroes, I don't know, but every black person in Southern California, I swear, has like this weird middle-class attitudes, and they don't give a shit about anyone else but themselves. And it's, that shit has always turned me off. And I remember one time in undergrad, I was in this mentorship program and I had a shitty ass GPA. So that's another thing. My GPA was probably like 2.5, 2.6. And, you know, to get a good job or go to grad school, you need at least over 3.0. I didn't come from a background where I was aided and abetted and, you know, greased up to be like amazing engineer and do well in my courses. Like, you know, these white kids had all these like AP physics courses in high school and had amazing teachers because they go to these charter schools and their parents pay for it, all this shit. I didn't have that access. So like when I went to school, I was just like, I was decent at like calculus and math and shit. So I was like, you know, I can get A's in those courses, but every other course I was fucking trash at. And I partied too, man. I had to have a good time because I don't want to be stressed out in school. So there was only like 5 black people total in my courses. And probably by the time I finished college, there was like 3 of us, you know. You know, that type of shit alienates you for one, right? You know, I made great friends too. Like one of my good friends was Palestinian and I had a really good white friend too, which, you know, it's hard not being around your folks because, you know, you come from similar struggles and you kind of apply that thing when you trying to learn together too, and you can relate on a much deeper level. I was in this mentor program. I think we were doing like some sort of resume thing, trying to get jobs or whatever. I think some black guy was like some sort of mentor. He was so harsh on me. He was so nice to these white and Latino kids, but he saw my GPA and was like, "You're not going to make it. I don't know why you're doing this major. You're like a failure, basically." I was like, "Damn, dude, like, who's paying you to do this shit?" Like, to just like demoralize me right now. I was like a junior in college. Luckily at the time, I was already doing undergraduate research and I was in like sort of a lab paid, luckily, because most of those positions are not paid. You know, I was doing this and then my black middle-class mentors that I was mentioning earlier were like, "You need to get a PhD because there's only like 0.6% of black people in the US have PhDs or something like that. And PhDs in STEM, so like science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And, you know, at the time I was just like, "Oh, I don't give a shit because I just want to get a job. I have this bachelor's in engineering. I should be able to find a job at whatever, Tesla or BMW or some crap," you know, just this mentality. And then maybe get an MBA or some point. And, you know, this was like kind of shiny thing at the time, which was like, become a project manager and you'll be fine for the rest of your life, which was complete bullshit. But, you know, this is what they tell you. You know, they kind of indoctrinate you in this sort of like these weird pipelines. My mentors were like, "No, you got to get a PhD because we need more black men that have PhDs." And luckily at the time I was already doing research, so it was kind of already on that pathway, but I still wasn't sure. I applied for grad school because I was like, "Okay, fuck it. I'm probably going to get denied everywhere. So let me just try." So I applied for grad school. I applied for the fellowships, you know, the NSF, Ford Foundation, et cetera, et cetera. This is like what you do. You know, I'm sure your listeners would be like, "Oh yeah, these are these, you know, think tanks or imperialist organizations, whatever." But, you know, these nonprofits like control fucking everything. It's unfortunate, but it's the fucking reality. So I was applying for grad school and I applied for these fellowships because the fellowships is what would fund you to go through grad school. And they tell you that funding doesn't matter because getting a PhD in STEM, your tuition is paid for and you don't have to worry about anything, which is true to an extent, or true in quotations, right? It's predatory. They tell you it's free, but it's on a predatory basis. So what that means is, yes, your tuition is covered. Yes, you get a small stipend or salary to survive, but there's all these strings attached. So one, you are completely attached to your PhD advisor who has complete control over your fucking career. You know, it's so like, say you don't get along with this person or have like a toxic relationship, that person can just fuck up your whole life. Like, because your letter of recommendation is what's going to get you to your next job, whether it be a faculty member at a university, whether it be a government scientist at a national lab, whether it be at a corporation. It's not the same as, you know, you get your little degree after taking some courses and then you apply for jobs and you get in after an interview. Having a grad degree is a whole other game that I think a lot of people don't recognize. And similar in other fields, not just STEM, it's also like, you know, in the social sciences, humanities, etc. So a lot of situations are similar. It's not identical, but it's similar. Yeah, so it's on a predatory basis. And so you're locked to this advisor who's controlling your life. So now we're talking about exploitation. We're talking about, you know, an employer. We're talking about a quote-unquote boss, right, which is in complete control of your whole life. And your salary, if you don't have a fellowship, that professor controls that shit. So that means they could not pay you if they want to. There's like a contract for a lot of graduate students across the U.S., which says, and these are for like non-unionized graduate students, which basically says you are paid for basically 20 hours a week for work. And then the other 20 hours is for class. So that's basically what's like sort of, you know, your student life. So you don't get paid for that. So you're basically getting exploited. And there's like some, you know, what we can talk about, like surplus value or whatever getting extracted from you, because you're actually working 60 to 70 hours a week to basically go through this publish or perish type of lifestyle and pipeline. So this is another story which exists within the STEM fields and also probably the other academic fields like social sciences and humanities. But it's really talked about in STEM fields because it's very political in a sense. So like, you know, you go into these programs, like for physics, for example, and you have all these top shots, like fucking, you know, great scientists, quote unquote, that have published in these great journals, Nature and Science journals and all this shit. And you're trying to be like them, because if you can't be like them, then you will not get a good job. And by a good job, that means like getting a faculty position at MIT, Harvard, Yale, etc. That is like the fucking totem pole that you're trying to reach. I myself did not come into grad school wanting to be like that. I wanted to do decently well, so I didn't have to deal with like racism and shit. So I came in like, okay, I'm gonna compete with my Chinese, Indian, white colleagues, and show them that I'm not a fucking dumbass, because, you know, what people perceive on black people is still this inferiority complex. It's like, oh, it's white paternalism shit. Like, oh, we helped you get here, so we must guide you to get to wherever you want to be because you're black and you come from this impoverished background and we must help you because you don't know any better or some crap. You know, it's this white paternalism, white supremacist attitude. And it permeates throughout all of academia. Like, it's very bad in STEM because there's so few of us. So anytime we have a fuck up or anything, we get the anti-blackness immediately. Like, it's in your fucking face. So yeah, so this is part of that story, but that was about this predatory sort of basis. Cause like basically when I was applying, I did not get any fellowships. I applied, I had my dear friend, her name's Desiree, who works at the Exploratorium in Berkeley. And she was a postdoc at Berkeley, et cetera, et cetera. But she was part of the sort of group of people that were getting more black PhDs into programs. But I gravitated towards her because she was way more sort of, had a way better like working class attitude towards things. And, you know, she had a very well grounding and understanding of things as opposed to the black men that were sort of trying to guide me. And she helped me with my applications. And on that note, which when I was applying for these fellowships, you know, I got their responses back, got declined or rejected. And, you know, on the NSF one, one of the comments was like, this guy needs to learn how to learn, you know, like these type of fucking like really like fucked up comments, like people that you just don't need to write as a reviewer. So it's just and it just demoralizes someone that like, where like, you know, your GPA doesn't mean shit, honestly, for graduate school. It's like, I don't even know why that's a measure for anything. Like your GPA, GRE, all that shit does not matter for fucking anything. You can learn everything on the fucking go or in the lab. Someone can teach you that shit. We don't need fucking a 5.0 GPA to perform well in grad school. So that's just a fact. And there's fucking statistics that prove this shit. So anyway, so I got those type of rejections. And then, you know, I applied for like 10 different schools and I only got accepted to, well, one program. So I stayed at my home university, which was UC Riverside, with my undergrad advisor that would eventually leave for Ohio State during my first year. So yeah, so now I'm completely attached to him because I did not get these fellowships. And now he's responsible for all of my funding, like how I get paid and shit. But, you know, he had this plan of leaving. So now this was a problem. Now I was like, shit, now how am I going to get paid if this guy's gone and all this these issues, right? When you get into your program, they offer you like a package, like a fellowship package, which doesn't really mean anything. It's just, here's how your funding will break down. You know, 4 years will be your advisor pays for you. 1 year is that the university pays you a stipend. So typically your first year while you're in classes, the university pays you a stipend. But since my GPA was trash, this is also deal with racism too, but or anti-blackness, but they decided, oh, we're going to put your stipend year, which is typically first year for everybody. They put it on my second year, which was completely just not a normal thing. I think me and maybe one other person dealt with the same thing. And I think it was my other black friend that was in the program that was a year ahead of me or something like that. Yeah, so now I was getting paid through my advisor, who was now at Ohio State, but I was not doing research because I take fucking courses. So like he was like, the way he's paying me is through these grants, which are through, you know, NSF, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I can't produce results with these grants because I'm taking fucking courses. And then I won't get my stipend till my second year, which was supposed to be to pay for my, basically my time during coursework. So I go through my first year. Everything went decently well. I then moved to Ohio State or Columbus, Ohio for my next 3.5 years or so. And then my second year, I get on this stipend thing. And what the university does is that they take you off of payroll, which is what's paying you your salary, which is, I didn't tell you the amount, but like per month, it's like $1,100 a month. So it's shit money if you're comparing it to what the cost of living is in California. And, you know, food and all this shit. I was in food stamps my first year in college because, you know, I was fucking poor, grad school. $1,100 a month is like roughly what you get. You know, there's not many taxes because you're not getting paid much. They got to pay for, like, if you have a car note, you got to pay for your car. If you have insurance, you got to pay for that shit. You got to pay for gas, your rent. You got to pay for, you know, anything, food, you know, and any other expenses that you possibly need. So it's just a ridiculous amount of money. And then, you know, the white folks, you know, who have generational wealth, savings, all this shit, they had nothing to worry about. But, you know, the black and Latino folks, we were the ones that were so stressed out about our own financial situation that we were just like, fuck, I gotta worry about this and doing my research, this publish and perish thing type thing. And it's just like stressful as fuck. So anyways, I moved to Ohio State in 2015 or so. And I switch over to the stipend program, which is what I was supposed to get my first year. And what they do is shut you off from payroll and switch you over to this other thing, which pays you through, you know, the sort of the grant and loan financial aid office thing. And the way that works is that you basically do not get paid for a month. And it's like complete bullshit because it's like, okay, I've been working, but like you're basically saying like, I must take a gap month off while you change your payment system to me and I lose a month of pay. So you want me to starve and not pay for my rent and all this shit. And then you have no solution for it. So this is part of my process towards, you know, I'm getting towards this sort of radicalization. I'm just getting more pissed off about everything. And then missed a month of pay. So like I was like poor as fuck. Couldn't afford gas, couldn't afford rent. I was late on fucking everything. It was just like horrifying. And then, you know, this is not even that bad compared to people that are on the streets currently unhoused, you know, people that are in extreme poverty. You know, I at least had a credit card. I at least had a little bit of like of a buffer like that I can go into more debt, you know, not a buffer with savings, but a buffer to go in more debt. So where there's other people out there that cannot get that buffer because, you know, there's a war on the poor. And for example, my brother, for example, like his bank penalized him for being poor. So he had so many overdraft fees that they closed off his account. He could not open an account for a checking account for another like 5 years. It was like some completely fucked up shit. So he would have to pull out strictly cash or go through his now wife for money because he couldn't like basically deposit his checks through his bank. In that sense, I was better off than like a lot of working poor people, working class people. But you know, there was still this serious exploitation that was happening within the university system that people don't normally talk about for some reason. So yeah, I was poor as fuck. You know, my advisor was trying to help me out, you know, but I was just like, leave me alone. I don't want to deal with your shit type thing. And then my graduate school experience was like, you know, basically the icing on the cake for me to really understand the connections between racism and exploitation, and also sort of the gender oppression as well, because I saw what was happening to women in my group. My advisor, I'm not going to name any names or anything, but, you know, he was a Japanese American guy, had a lot of like mental issues. And this is not a diss on people with actual disabilities, but this guy had like serious social interaction problems with people like that he was managing in his group. Because as an advisor, you still have a role as a manager. You have to manage your projects, your funding, and how it distributes to students and postdocs, and, you know, how people interact within your group. And he did not know how to fucking do that. He would create the most toxic fucking environment in existence. Like, we were the fucking laughingstock of the Department of Physics at Ohio State, because everyone wanted to stay away, because they were just like, that guy's fucking crazy. Actually, I was kind of already radicalized at this point, but like, this was still kind of, I'm still kind of building that militancy, right? So Trump was elected, and then we had these group meetings, right? So, and what group meetings are in grad school are when, you know, you basically have different projects in the group. Everyone comes together, someone gives a presentation, and then you discuss that presentation and then also update on other projects just to see what's going on. But after Trump was elected, this was a really weird time. Relatively diverse group of nationality and race and sort of gender as well. Not really, but we had, you know, Chinese nationals, we had black folks, we had Egyptian folks, we had Russian folks, we had, you know, white women, we had Chinese women and Indians, men and women. And so my advisor decides like he's going to give a presentation on this topic of racism. And it's just like a fucking shit show, because like we all know him as like this awkward motherfucking guy. Has some serious social issues and does not know how to interact with human beings. So we just know it's just not going to turn out well with this conversation. So, and he's discussing a good article, and I'm trying to remember the title of the article. It was like a post on Facebook about like, do my white friends know something about like racism or something like that? I forgot what it is. And it was a black woman that posted it. And it's an article somewhere too on some black magazine. And then he was talking about like this woman, you know, that wrote the article, her friend, her white friend responded to her post and said some shit about racism. And then she responded about her experiences as a black woman. And so my advisor's going through like this article, like highlighted everything, and it was starting pretty good. Like, oh, this is a good article, right? And then he turns it on its fucking head. So at the end of it, we thought the conclusion was going to be like, yeah, you know, fuck Trump, you know, fuck white supremacy, this is good, you know. But he makes it all about himself. And he's like, so basically all of you in this room are white people. And it, like I mentioned earlier, it was like a bunch of different nationalities. You know, there's probably like 3 or 4 white folks. You know, a white woman, a Russian white guy, and a white Jew. And then he basically calls all the Chinese men white men. And then he calls my friend Adam, who's Egyptian, he's African, but like he considers himself like Middle Eastern, but like, I'm like, you're black, dude. But, you know, he's darker skin. He's probably like my tone, sort of light skin, brother. But, and he calls him a white guy. And then he tries to clarify this by saying, you guys all do this sort of white man thing when you explain science. So it's like, he was explaining like, oh, you all kind of beat around the bush or bullshit and you like lie and manipulate people like white people do, which was totally like fucking incorrect in terms of the people he was talking about, because he was actually more reflecting of himself, which he does that shit himself. And yeah, and then it just like turned everyone the fuck off. We all like responded to him, but it was like really awkward. And remember what I was talking about earlier, this person has like your whole life in their hands. So like if you get in any sort of confrontation or conflict, this person can like fuck your whole life up, you know. So yeah, so my advisor says this shit, calls everyone out supposedly on, you know, trying to call out sort of white chauvinism, but like not really understanding what the fuck he was really talking about. And we all like kind of responded as a group and was just like, you're full of shit type thing, not in those words, but you know. And then a year later, over the span of the next year, which was 2016 going into 2017, the first year of Trump, all this stuff was happening. The next fall, you know, my older colleagues were about to graduate and all this stuff. And we were like, okay, we're going to fucking go off on our advisor now. So we all like met up as a group and we're like, okay, we're going to all go to HR. We're all going to have this meeting and we're all going to complain about this shit. And this is also part of my sort of, you know, understanding of things, like realizing that HR doesn't do shit. It's more of a wing of the corporation or the university in this sense. So it protects the university. It protects the people that are doing the harm, not the people that are getting harmed, right? So, and this is where I was kind of like starting to talk to people about union organizing at Ohio State, you know, but there was just zero fucking interest in my department at the time. They had this little committee that would talk about issues, and they started a little diversity and inclusion council, but they called it a climate and diversity council. This was like 2017, 2018, some shit like that. And clearly didn't do shit. And at the same time, all this shit was happening. There's people that were in my group that were getting kicked out or leaving. Like we had some queer folks that were in the group that just couldn't deal with it. They left, which put more pressure on, for example, myself as a black person, because like, you know, we had this white queer people in the group that were like, okay, fuck it. I can just move on wherever I want to do. And then I'm like, I'm stuck in a situation because I'm a UC Riverside student at Ohio State. I can't leave the group because I would have to move back, change groups, and probably do another 5 years of graduate school. And I want to be in school for 15 years. I was talking about unions a little bit, but no, there was just no interest at all by anyone. Everyone was still sort of like liberalism and like, you know, we can figure this out ourselves, you know. Ohio had like this right to work type thing where graduate students couldn't really organize a union. They had to do it through other means, and had these small like councils that had some liaison through the president's office of the university and blah, blah, blah. Didn't really do anything, had no power. Through this time, you know, two things were happening. So one was there was a story of a woman, and I'm not going to give away any names, but basically sexual abuse and sexual assault was fucking prevalent and built into the department's sort of culture, right? And by that, I mean, like, it wasn't just our group that had these similar issues, which I'll talk about a little bit. So there was a story of one woman who was in another group a couple years ago that my friend Adam knew, and she had left for a conference or something overseas with a postdoc and was, you know, sexually assaulted, was raped by this postdoc, and came back to the university and went to HR, went to the faculty leadership, all that stuff, and quit the program because they didn't do anything. And then would send these emails every, I guess, couple of months, years or so, kind of cryptic emails to the email list because she still had access to it, telling about her story. And a couple years later, and like the year after I left Ohio State, which was 2019 when I was in California finishing up my PhD, I met some friends at a conference in 2019 and learned that this woman had committed suicide. And it was just a fucking horrible thing. And I never met this woman, but like it just confirmed so many things I was feeling at the time. Because in my group, my advisor had a sort of a thing, which I mean had a sort of attraction and an orbit around a specific woman in my group. And she was, you know, she was, I guess you can call it like an immigrant. So like, you know, she was a visa student from Hong Kong or China, and she joined the group around the time I did, but I was an undergrad. She was a grad student. So she was like 2 years older than me. Sorry. She became his like favorite student, you know, the sort of favoritism where like he would put her name on every single paper in the group. And when she would do virtually nothing to achieve that status, you know, typically you would contribute in some way, either scientifically, like through discussing the projects, you know, through some like theoretical discussion, or experimentally, you would contribute some experimental contribution. But she didn't do anything. She would just kind of just linger around and do nothing, which I'm all for gender liberation, women's liberation, you know, but all of us in graduate school are fucking fighting for our goddamn lives and survival. Like we're trying to fight for the most crumbs, you know. It's really a dog eat dog type thing, which is horrible to say, but it fucking is. And, you know, we go at each other's throats because this environment's so fucking toxic. And it's really hard to really develop any sort of unity, especially if the advisor is like, you know, micromanaging and controlling everybody's fucking move. So this is why I'm very pro, like, grad students need to be organized because they have virtually no fucking power and there's all this abuse. But so anyway, so you had like this sort of orbit around this woman in the group, and she was married to my colleague as well. who didn't know any of the shit that was going on at the time. They are now divorced, but they were married at the time. And the most strangest fucking interactions I would just see happen where this man would, he's fucking like in his late 50s, and then she is in like her late 20s. And he would fucking like go on bike rides with her and then invite her into his office. And, you know, I would get invited to these meetings with them for a project, supposedly. But then we end up talking about something totally different. And then he would offer his clothes to her. He would stroke her hair, massage her back, all this like fucking fucked up shit. And it was just like, I was experiencing like someone being sexually fucking abused and assaulted in front of my face. And I didn't know what the fuck to do, because I, you know, this thing where in graduate school, this guy has control over your whole fucking life. Like, you cannot do shit, because if you complain to HR, that word is going to get back to him, and he's going to find out who did it, and then you're going to get fucked. So, like, it was such a shitty situation where I couldn't save anyone, because it was just like, this thing's happening, and like, we can only talk about it in our small little spaces as students, but we had no fucking power to fight anything. This was just all a combination and conglomerate of all this shit happening that I was seeing, and I was getting micromanaged, exploited, all this shit, and all this. And then, you know, eventually in grad school, I decided I'm going to fucking travel to another country every fucking summer and New Year's. Even though I was fucking poor, I just fucking put it on my Chase Sapphire Reserve fucking card and said, fuck it, I'm going to just go, because I don't give a shit about the debt right now, because I need to get the fuck out of this country and out of this lab type thing. One year I went to Southern Mexico, to Chiapas. So when I was traveling there, I was reading some communist literature. So I was reading actually Robin Kelly's Hammer and Hoe. And that book just fucking completely turned my world upside down. Like, it was just all this information that I had no fucking clue about that, like, happened in this country, like, about the Black Freedom Movement. I thought everything started at 1960. Like, obviously, abolition, you know, all that. But I thought the real, like, you know, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, civil rights, 60s, Black Panthers, okay. But I had no fucking clue about the Communist Party. Like, that was completely erased from my knowledge, my history. It was completely kept away from me my whole entire life due to, obviously, the Red Scare, McCarthyism. None of that was taught to me ever. On that trip, we went to Chiapas together. I read it, the whole thing, and I was just like, holy shit. I think once I read that, I said, fuck it, I'm going to join the Communist Party, because I was like, I need a political home, you know, type thing, and I need someone that's a space that really about the shit, you know, for Black people and for the working class and for freedom, you know, for liberation. From then, it's just been a fucking downhill, not battle, but downhill, you know, just from there. Like, my God, my library is so intensified. And so this was when I was still in Ohio too, right? So I joined when I was living out there, and I had became in contact with, you know, some very old steel workers, elders that were, you know, professors as well. I met the person who leads the Communist Party in Ohio and Columbus specifically, but the district leader. She was the last person to interview Bob Marley before his death, which was insane to me. You know, I was learning so much about the history of the party that I had not known about, because I'd obviously just known about like this thing in the 30s and 40s, and there's just so much more I needed to learn and all this shit. But I was just getting exposed at that point. And then I left Ohio. I left for California because I was just like, I need to finish my PhD and I don't have enough time to organize really, because I just need to finish and then I'll be like full ready once I'm done. So I was in the club out there where they were organizing. And I also went to a talk at Ohio University, where one of our Black leaders who ran for vice president in the 70s, Jarvis Tyner, gave a talk about all the African Americans in the CP throughout its history. And so I moved to California, and so I joined the clubs out there, which, just to give you some background, if people even care what's going on in the party, I guess. But, you know, there was a major sort of split in the CP in the 90s, you know, people like Angela Davis left, Charlotte Mitchell, etc. You know, it's very complex. You know, I don't want to get into any details because, you know, everyone has their own story. But basically, the Bay Area and DC, where we are now, was decimated from that split. And people stole money afterwards, and, you know, all these things were happening at the same time. The Soviet Union fell, obviously, so that played a huge role in people leaving. And, you know, just some old beef that just like lingered over the years, and it just kept on. And I was learning about all this when I was getting involved, because I was just like, okay, why the fuck are people like, why isn't this party like massive, like what I read about, you know? Then I moved out here for a job in DC, and, you know, I was in the party, and I luckily got in touch with people that were way more active than anywhere else I had been. So, and I was done with my graduate school, so I was just ready to fucking work. And then came to DC, and then this I came to a meeting. First meeting I came out here, and the first thing was this Claudia Jones School for Political Education idea. And I was just like, let's fucking do it. And then a couple months later, the pandemic hit. But yeah, it's kind of just been this process. And, you know, I learn every day, but I've been fortunate to be in spaces with some incredible people. And, you know, this last year was a long year of trial and error, you know, a summer of spontaneity and rebellion, where a lot of people learned a lot in the movements for Black Lives, obviously, but for Black liberation in particular, right? You know, a lot of folks are turning towards more liberatory solutions, which for most people are pushing themselves towards socialism. And a lot of people are still scared, you know, there's still this sort of cloud of McCarthyism, Red Scare. You know, it's a risky thing to do, right? To be a communist, right? And it's even more risky to be a communist with a capital C, a card carrying one at that, because, you know, you're putting yourself at risk, like your job, all this stuff, because the party's been, you know, one of the most attacked parties in the history of this country. But it's still been here for 102 years. So through all of its ups and downs, and it's still a force and still building, and people still want to understand what the alternative to this shitty ass world we live in, right? Without exploitation, without oppression, without imperialism, right? Like, we want to end all this shit. And it's our task, right, as workers in, some may call, a fully developed imperialist country, with fascist-like tendencies, right, that it is our primary task to defeat monopoly capitalism, which is imperialism, and to develop strong international solidarity with other nations of people that are under the plunder of colonialism, imperialism, sanctions, blockades. It is extremely important that we are, if you're going to call yourself a radical or call yourself a socialist or a communist, you gotta understand that sort of primary contradiction in the globe, the world, right? And we still have a revolutionary task here to fucking help with that contradiction, because it's our country that's fucking destroying the world. It's the rich white capitalists of our lands destroying this planet and the people that inhabit it. So we have a task, we have an obligation to fight imperialism. But the thing that divides us up is fucking racism, obviously sexism and male supremacy and you know, any other form of gender oppression. To unite our class, the working class, and even sections from, you know, what we would call like the middle class or petty bourgeoisie, is the fight for the centrality of the fight against racism. So that means it is our obligation, specifically white workers, actually, their special obligation, because it's a special question if we're talking about linen, to fight against white supremacy and organize Black and brown workers into the movement as well, because we cannot have any sort of go it alone strategy. Unite the whole fucking class, have Black leadership, fight for our class, unity of our class, and fight for the liberation of all nationally and racially oppressed people.